This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in wa ba'd. So tonight, inshallah ta'ala, we continue from where we left off last week, and I'm trying to help you get a sense of what the first maybe 2 years of or year and a half of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's time in Medina looked like. And it was a mix of having to adapt to a new and different climate, not just an environmental one, but also a social one, an economical one, and a political one. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam had a number of things that he had to do at the beginning, in terms of building the masjid and writing the constitution and establishing the brotherhood so that people could live in, find places to live, make sure there's housing. Mu'akha, is a spiritual meaning, but really it's housing. It's making sure people had homes, places to live. And that was quite a challenge. And of course, as it worked out and as people got a little more stable, the Sahaba started feeling a little bit better about this new transition. And Medina began to thrive. It began to thrive. When I say thrive, I'm not talking about the economical thriving. That would take a number of years after he passed away, alayhi salatu wasalam, to actually occur, at least in the way that was noticeable. But it was the spiritual thriving, the social thriving that began. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam took a few initiatives in the midst of all of this, and one of them was he performed a census of Medina. So he had all the information, and I talked about that last time, but I think it's something that's worth keeping in mind. The fact that he did this, alayhi salatu wasalam, to me always stands out as such a forward-thinking aspect of his character, that he's like, I need to know who I have in Medina, how many people can bear arms, how many families, how many people are married, unmarried, what age groups are they, how many children, people from different tribes, how many are they? Where are they living? So alayhi salatu wasalam had information. He knew the people he was working with, alayhi salatu wasalam. That allowed him, that helped him to plan accordingly. So that was the first one. The second initiative was that he established intelligence groups. Interestingly, we call these mukhabara today, and they always have a bad connotation attached to them. But during the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's time, having uyun, having people who would basically sweep the peninsula and bring back information was very important. So you had Talha ibn Ubaidillah and Sa'id ibn Zayd, the two people who were responsible for this for this aspect of things. And they had a team of people, and their job was to make sure that the Prophet ﷺ was well informed of any movements that Quraysh was performing, or any movements that could be possibly performed, and what the other tribes were saying, and what was going on in the periphery of Medina, because back then communication was obviously a challenge, and it was not easy for you to gather information. So alayhi salatu wasalam always had these groups, Talha and Sa'id, that's what they did. And they brought reports to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam on a weekly basis. And they did this, and I'll give you examples of that, because I'll show you moments when Talha or Sa'id would come back to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam and tell him, this is what we found. And that would obviously, we're gonna see an example of that in a few moments. And the third initiative are the scouting groups. The scouting groups, which is where he would send alayhi salatu wasalam small groups of the Sahaba with a leader. They were armed, and that was go to see, and if the intelligence group said there's a small gathering, we're not exactly sure who they are, and we're not exactly sure why they're there, but they're 60 or 50 kilometers west of northwest of Medina or southeast of Medina, and we don't know what's going on. The Prophet alayhi salam would set out scouting groups to see what the issue is. Why? Because he was trying to keep his borders and periphery alayhi salam safe. He knew what was going to happen. He knew that Quraysh was not going to let this slide. Actually, the amount of anger that existed in Mecca after he made it out alayhi salatu wasalam and began building this city was off the charts. The oppression that the Sahaba who were left behind underwent was actually worse than some of the stories that I told you maybe a couple of months ago at the beginning of his prophecy alayhi salatu wasalam. It's like Quraysh failed to contain this. This is how they look at it. They failed to contain him and his followers. And now he's no longer in Mecca, he's outside of their control. and now they look bad in front of all of the tribes of Arabia. So for them, they took out all that anger on the Sahaba who were left there. So that was a big problem because the Prophet ﷺ still felt responsible for their safety and wanted bargaining yani, chips to be able to ensure their ongoing safety. It was definitely a difficult thing. And there's many scouting troops. Actually, there's too many scouting troops within Sirah for me to even begin to tell you the stories of. There's too many things happen. So, and a lot of them are very technical. So I'm not going to really go into too many details. But I do want to tell you the story or the group or the troops of Abdullah ibn Jahsh radiallahu anhu arda. One of the Zainab's brother, who was the Prophet alayhi salam's wife. They weren't married at that time, but she would later become his wife. And Abdullah was one of the early Sahaba and her brother. And Abdullah radiallahu anhu is a muhajir. He's from Mecca. He's from Quraysh. He's related to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, closely related. So the Prophet ﷺ sent with him 8 people. It was a small scouting group. It was not a large group. And the Prophet ﷺ gave them instructions. He said, look, you go, there's some troops or a large gathering of people in a certain area. When you go, scout them out, find out how many, don't cause any trouble. Like don't engage. Do not engage with them. Just get me information from them and just establish like a protection point so that they see you, so that they know that they can't, that they've been scouted, they've been seen. For those of you like me who are not militarily oriented and don't fully understand the art of war, these are things that matter. Not that I fully understand, but it matters. If there's a small group that is camping in a certain area, the owner outside of a city or outside the gates or the borders of a country, then the country will go and establish a point for themselves and make themselves visible, or at least make it clear to them that they're there, so that it's less likely that they'll engage or that they'll move forward. So Abdullah radiallahu anhu took his troop, and he went and he did that. And they were supposed to stay there for a couple of nights, up to over a week or so. Overnight, one of those nights, a few of the people of that troop made their way to the camp of Abdullah, and there was a back and forth, and they were able to take a hostage or two. The narration is different. Some of them say Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas was one of them. Some of them don't. But they were able to take one or two hostages. So Abdullah radiallahu anhu, whose troops had gone down, he only had 8 people, now he had 6. So he looked, he knew that there was a caravan that belonged to this group, a caravan of goods that was a part of this group's tribe that was coming. So he went and his plan was to stop them, to negotiate, so that we have the caravan, give us back our two people, and they do an exchange. That was his plan. And the caravan belonged to a man by the name of Ala ibn al-Hadrami. He owned the caravan. So Abdullah went and tried to stop the caravan. And it went south. The caravan was actually way more armed than they thought. This is at the beginning of the intelligence movements of the Prophet ﷺ's groups. So it was not bulletproof yet. He didn't know how much, it was actually heavily armed. So a little bit of a fight happened. And the Muslims ended up killing someone. On the other side, Ala ibn al-Hadrami ended up dying. Now that was all fine, because this is not an issue. It was open combat, so it was fine. The problem with it, and this is what Abdullah ibn Jahsh did not notice, is that night was the first night of Rajab. Anyone know why that's important? Yeah, it's Shahrullah al-Haram, right? There are a number of Ashhur al-Hurum, right? Anyone, you know what the Ashhur al-Hurum are? What are the 4 sacred months? So Dhul Qa'dah, Dhul Hijjah, al-Muharram, and Rajab, right? So it's right there. So Rajab, that was the first night of it. And technically, Abdullah initiated this problem with the caravan. So technically, the Muslims are the ones who started this. At the first night of one of the sacred months. Now, the Sahaba argued that we thought it was the 30th night of the month before. But it didn't work. The propaganda spread. It spread like wildfire. Quraysh said, Muhammad yaqtulu fil ashhur al-hurum. Muhammad is killing people in the sacred months, and that became the whole issue. Now Abdullah ibn Jahsh, because he was able to hold the caravan, was able to get back Sa'd and the hostage and go back to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. So technically it worked, but there's a guy who died. They come back to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. The Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam is very upset, telling them, "Alam ukhbirkum? Did I not say not to engage? Did I not specifically say don't engage with them? And of course, Abdullah radiallahu anhu's, he says that was the worst day of his entire life. When he came back to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam and saw him, how angry he was with him because of what they had done. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam paid the diyah, meaning paid the expiation for this person that they killed, Ala ibn al-Hadrami. They paid the diyah for him. And he chastised the Muslims for doing this. But the propaganda spread from Quraysh that how is it that Muslim, Muhammad is killing in the... And they started using this incident to make the Prophet ﷺ and the Sahaba look bad, as if they are, transgressing at a wrong time. So the Quran would actually come and address this. The Quran would address this. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الشَّهْرِ الْحَرَامِ قِتَالٍ فِيهِ. They're talking and they're asking about the sacred month, fighting in the sacred month. قُلْ, say this. قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ. It's a big mistake for someone to initiate combat and transgress within the sacred month. Agreed. وَصَدٌ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَكُفْرٌ بِهِ وَالْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ وَإِخْرَاجُ أَهْلِهِ مِنْهُ أَكْبَرُ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. However, pushing back against the way of Allah, disbelieving in Allah, holding the Masjid al-Haram hostage, kicking people out of their homes is worse. In the eyes of Allah, that's worse. The oppression that happened and the removal of people from their homes and the refusal of the Prophet alayhi salallahu alayhi wa sallam's message, that is worse in the eyes of Allah. It's worse than fighting. But the Quran came and acknowledged that they made a mistake. And this is a really important point when you study this verse in the Quran. That the Quran came and acknowledged and admitted that the Muslims were wrong. They were wrong. Now, what the other group did was worse, but you are still wrong. قُلْ قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ. It was a big mistake. That you should have not initiated combat at the night within Ashur al-Hurum. This objectivity is actually it's amazing actually. And it's worthy of our contemplation as Muslims. Just because you're oppressed does not give you a green light to do whatever you want. And for you to be to be seen or considered as blameless. You cannot be blamed because you're the oppressed or because you're the weaker. It doesn't work that way. No, if you make a mistake, you still made a mistake. If you're oppressed and you made a mistake, it's still a mistake. It doesn't stop being a mistake just because you're oppressed or because you underwent an injustice. However, that mistake that was made is not equal to the act of oppression and injustice that actually occurred. This is a very difficult balance that I find Muslims can't seem to figure out. We can't seem to figure out this very clear, simple balance that the Quran brought forward in this example. And we have many examples, by the way, in the Quran that talk about this. The Quran could have come and said, no, Abdullah has made no mistake. Because Quraysh has been oppressing you for a long time, so it's all fair in love and war. It's all fair because, no, قُلْ قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ. Say, no, it's a big mistake for them to initiate combat. As the Prophet ﷺ said, see, the Prophet ﷺ did not exonerate Abdullah and his troop and say, no, it's okay. هُمَّ كُلُّهُمْ كَفَرَ. They're all misbelievers, they're all enemies. It doesn't matter that you killed a couple of them. No, the Prophet ﷺ was actually upset and Abdullah was demoted for a while. Like Abdullah did not lead another troop for a while. He had to prove himself back in order to be given that privilege again. So he was actually punished by the Prophet ﷺ for the mistake that he made. We have to understand this. As Muslims, we absolutely have to comprehend this basic term, this basic concept. Just because you are mistreated or you are transgressed against or you are undergoing an injustice or does not give you a green light or a free ticket to do whatever you want and then people all have to accept because you were once mistreated. No. When you make a mistake, it will be called out as well. However, mistakes can be weighed. And one mistake can be way worse and much heavier and much more problematic than another one. And that's what the Quran came and said. وَصَدٌ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَكُفْرٌ بِهِ وَالْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ وَإِخْرَاجُ مِنْ أَهْلِهِ مِنْهُ أَكْبَرَ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. What Quraysh has done to you is way worse in the eyes of Allah. But still, قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ. That was the first thing. The Quran didn't start with what Quraysh did wrong. The Quran came and admitted that the Muslims made a mistake. You shouldn't have went and initiated combat in the Ashur al-Hurum. Period. However, don't try and equalize this. The propaganda that you're using is garbage. The propaganda that you're using doesn't go anywhere. Quraysh. No, no. What you've done is way worse. You want to play this ticket? Fine. But it does, no, that's not how this works. What you've done is worse. And actually, this verse became more popular than all the propaganda that Quraysh put out. This ayah became more famous in Arabia than the propaganda that Quraysh was trying to send out. You know why? Because it was honest. People like honesty. People appreciate honesty. It takes a big person to admit to a mistake. And not everyone does that. People are tired of polarized narratives. A narrative that only tells one side of the story, purposefully so. Most people have a reasonable IQ and they can figure out, they can sniff it out, that this is just your narrative and you have no interest in acknowledging any aspect of your own mistake at all in this. You're just going to blame the other group, the other side altogether. People know that. They feel it. They sense it. They're not impressed by it. They'll listen to it. They'll listen to your argument. And if it suits them, they'll probably even pick it up. But they know there's something missing. Everyone does. What conflict in history ever existed where one side was 100% wrong? Huh? Yeah, no, yeah, your problems with your spouse don't qualify either. Yeah, yeah. There is no problem in the history of humanity where one side was 100% wrong. And if you come and say that, I tune people like that out immediately. Like, it takes 2 minutes of talking. If I start sensing that this person sees no accountability, they are not able to see any aspect of their own mistake, I tune them out. Wait for them to finish. Say, Barakallahu feek, we'll make dua for you. That's the best I can offer. Allah marak. May life slap you around enough to teach you, and then come back again, and then talk to me with some degree of logic. Talk to me in a way that makes sense. No, very rarely. When I say rarely, as in like one in a million. Yeah, you're not one of them. Neither am I. Any conflict or problem that exists out there, you're carrying some degree of it. Whether it's a small conflict or a large conflict. The Quran, in the midst of Muslims still being fully oppressed, being a Muslim was not legal in Arabia, if you understand what I'm saying. It wasn't allowed. In the midst of that degree of basic rights being deprived of Muslims at that time, the Quran still came and said, قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ. You shouldn't have done that. That's your mistake. And it started with that. It didn't come and defend them. It didn't come and justify their mistake. It didn't rationalize what they did. No, it came and said they were wrong. But you are way more wrong. But Quraysh, you're way more wrong. You don't get away. You can't get away with just using what they did. No, it doesn't work that way. That is a refreshing degree of honesty, which is why this became much more famous. Which is why even the disbelievers, like, oh, that's interesting. That Muhammad actually, because they don't believe that this is the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mushrikeen, but then Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam held his own troops accountable for their mistake. And he paid the diyah. He actually paid the diyah. When you kill someone, there's an amount that is owed, right? When it's by mistake or it shouldn't have happened. He paid it, alayhi salatu wasalam, because he said, nope, we shouldn't have done that. You're wrong. He didn't defend it. He didn't justify it. He demoted Abdullah. We need that degree of objectivity. We need the ability to hold ourselves accountable. This is the essence of my messaging as a Muslim speaker. The essence of my messaging is that before we point fingers at different parties and groups, and before I waste time, honestly, talking about the dictatorships that exist in the Middle East and the people who are and who don't like us and people who aren't treating us fairly and those who are before I do any of that, where's our accountability? Show me what we have to first of all figure out what we're not doing right. And we may need to do that for a couple of decades. We may need to spend the next few decades just doing that, acknowledging where we went wrong, where we are not performing at the level that we should, where we're not fulfilling our purpose appropriately. And then, once we're at that level, you know what's going to happen? You're going to find no point in pointing fingers at any other group. You will find that once you stop being the victim, when you stop seeing yourself as a victim, when you stop hoping for people to sympathize with you, and empathize with you, and clap for you, or weep for you, or fight for you, when you stop doing that, and you actually take the responsibility upon yourself, and you see what you're not doing, and you start doing it, you won't find any reason to actually point fingers at those who are against you. Because those who are against you are always going to be there. They're never going to go away. They're always going to be there. For you to think otherwise is very naive. It's very naive to think that the other group somehow is going to... No, they're not going to change. They're not going to start respecting you. They're not going to treat you fairly. But do your part. This is what the Quran was about. Yeah, the Quran was very clear. You were wrong. Don't do that again. Don't initiate combat in Ashhur al-Hurum. I don't care why. Don't do it again. It was your fault. But in the bigger scheme of things, they are the oppressors, not you, and you are the oppressed. The Quran is not interested in also just chastising the Muslims. No, the Quran wants the balance. I don't think we have that balance at all. I don't think we have that balance at all as Muslims. Like not even the smallest whiff of it. I don't think we have the ability to see ourselves at fault. I think we see everyone at fault. I know that because I sit with people and I watch them speak and I listen to them and I hear them talk about things, and I know that we don't have the ability, we don't have that mentality. Everyone's at fault. The hukumat are at fault, whether in the Middle East or in the West. The organizations are at fault. The system is at fault. The banks are at fault. Big Pharma is at fault. The school's at fault. Everyone's at fault, but God forbid me. I ain't at fault. If everyone's like me, the world would be good because I'm perfect. That is a very, very ill mentality. That's a very ill mentality. No, I can't control all the aforementioned groups. The only one I can control is me. Let me see what I should have done differently. And let me hold myself to the standard that I should be holding myself to. I tell you that once you do that, once enough of us do that, we won't need to spend any time complaining about what other people are doing or what other groups are, how they are behaving or how they're treating us. I guarantee you this, but we're not good at that. There's this unfortunate victim mentality that we have grown up with. It's not healthy, and I don't like it. You're not a victim. We're not victims. If we're victims of anything, we're victims of our own failures, of our own shortcomings. I know that because that's what the Quran taught, and that's what the Prophet ﷺ taught us. This is a very hard reality to accept. Your nafs will fight against this. You're probably telling yourself that I'm full of it, and you're waiting for me to move on to something else after it. And that's all right. But I'm telling you that this is the realization that you need to come to. Because when you come to it, and you accept it, and you are at peace with the fact that you are not doing your part appropriately, and that you are at fault, and that you are responsible to a certain degree within the limitations of your capacity, and you start actually looking towards what it is that you could do differently, and you start owning this problem, and you become a champion of the cause, then things change for you, and you function at a different level. And you don't need encouragement. You don't need people to remind you. You stop complaining about small stuff. And you stop fighting with people. And you stop wasting time with trivial issues because you have a cause that you're working towards. And you're going to continue to work towards it relentlessly until the day you die. And if enough of us did that, then things would be very different. But we don't have that. We don't have that. We have 2 billion people sit back and complain about stuff and want to free card to say and do anything because we're victims and we're not. They weren't offered this victim mentality when they made a mistake. It was a troop of eight. The group they were scouting was 200. The caravan had 80 men. It was eight of them. That's it. And they weren't even trying to kill them. They were just, there's a million ways for me to justify what happened and forgive them for it. And the Quran said, no, qitalun fi kabir. You shouldn't have initiated. I'm not making this up. Go back and read the tafsir of this ayah. There's no other tafsir for this ayah aside what I'm telling you. Like it's one story in every single book, because there's no second, like some stories, some verses, some scholars say this is the story, some scholars say that's the story. This is the only story for this ayah. There's nothing else. There's no sariyatu Abdullah ibn Jahsh. That's it. And that's what happened. And the Quran came and held them accountable first. Not missing the fact that Quraysh is an oppressive regime in the region that is denying Muslims their basic human rights, but still holding accountable the Muslims who didn't make the right choice. We go back to that and you'll see change. We go back to that as Muslims. We go back to that. We have the, if we, when we build the capacity to go back to that, to be objective, to see things with the dimensions and the complexity that they have, to point out where mistakes have been made, to own them and acknowledge them, to maintain the bigger picture, and to continue to hold ourselves accountable and to accept. Once we do that, you'll see that we start to change, and we don't have that capacity. I live in this place, but we don't. We're not even close. Which is why my messaging will continue to be about self-accountability, but our lack of doing our role. And I'm not going to get on the minbar and make you feel better about yourself by, you know, by calling out the president of the United States or calling out the president of some other country. I'm not going to do it. You're going to feel better if I do. I'm not doing it. Because I already know that I don't expect anything else. And if you expect something else, then you're actually even more naive than I am. If you expect them to do, if you expect someone else to care for you, if you expect someone else to value your blood and value your life and to bring you justice, then you have no idea how planet Earth works. You have no idea how life actually functions. If you think someone else is going to actually care about your future aside from you, and if we don't actually take that accountability upon ourselves, we'll never get anywhere. So that's what I'm going to continue to do. Because if the Quran at this time came and said, قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ, this monumental ayah, at a time where there's a million reasons why you could have just looked the other way from this mistake, it didn't, then I have no reason to do that either. Let's talk about this cool thing. Like I told you, the intelligence groups all over. Talha and Sa'id came to the Prophet ﷺ and said, Ya Rasulullah, Abu Sufyan, this is what they told him. Huh? This is the degree of detail. This is the second year of his hijrah, alayhi salatu wasalam, towards just before Ramadan. Abu Sufyan took all of the wealth that he stole, that was stolen from your house, and stolen from Abu Bakr and Umar and all the Muhajirin and Suhaib al-Rumi, and all the wealth that was stolen was put in one caravan that they sent with Abu Sufyan specifically so that he could go grow that money and come back and give it to the nobles of Quraysh. We've been watching this money, we've been monitoring it. It's in Damascus and he's on his way back. He's on his way back with your wealth, with our wealth, Ya Rasulullah. Now they didn't come and do that because they had an agenda. They did that because he told them specifically to keep an eye out. He told them, as you sweep the area, I want you to keep an eye on the caravan that they're going to use, that they're going to send within our wealth, the wealth of the Muhajirin. And Talha and Sa'id at the beginning were like, well, why, Ya Rasulullah? Why do we, it's a caravan, it's not, just do it. And tell me when it leaves, and tell me when it arrives in Sham, and tell me when it's on its way back. So they did. They gave the Prophet ﷺ all this information, and they told him, just at the beginning of the first Ramadan that he would run, alayhi salatu wasalam, they would tell him, it's on its way back. And in 15 to 16 days, it's going to be close to us, they're going to come by us. So the Prophet ﷺ held on to that information. And the Sahaba enjoyed their first Ramadan. Ramadan, obviously, is a beautiful time. There's less than 100 days left, by the way, until Ramadan comes by again. So it was the first Ramadan, first time Taraweeh, first time, like a lot of things, and Ramadan's a beautiful thing. But the Prophet ﷺ was counting the days coming closer, asking for updates. Where is it now? Oh, it's close to Tabuk. Now where it is? Oh, now it's close to this. Now where is it? He's figuring out how far away it is from Medina. Yeah. 1,000 camels. 1,000. Understand? 1,000 camels? It's a lot. Have you seen 1,000 camels before? I haven't. They're not bare. No, these camels are packed with merchandise. This is a big caravan. 40 guards. 40 guards on horseback. This wasn't a small caravan. This was a strong and large and well-armed caravan. Right? On his way back, 40 guards. Yeah. The Prophet ﷺ would find out through his intelligence groups that this caravan was now maybe 5-6 kilometers to the northwest of Medina. So the Prophet ﷺ gathered quickly a group of people. The number he was able to gather was 313, and he was the 314th person, alayhi salatu wasalam. And the idea was that they were going to go out and try and take this caravan. Retrieve what is theirs. It's their wealth, they want to take back what's theirs. They don't want whatever wealth belongs to Quraysh within the caravan. They just want their own. And then you have these verses in Surah Al-Anfal. Now, you can tell the story of the Battle of Badr from two distinct points of view. You can tell it from the point of view of the Sahaba, who beautified the story after it happened, and you can tell it from the standpoint of the Qur'an. That didn't. The Qur'an doesn't sugarcoat anything. It doesn't beautify or doesn't use a beautifying brush over anything. The Qur'an comes and talks about things as they were, as they happened. No sugarcoating of anything. The Sahaba, obviously, after something occurred, would reflect, and this is the human, we all do that, anything that you go through in your life, you will tell me the story after it's done. After you reflected on it, after you've thought about it, after you've come to conclusions, you'll come and tell me, this is what happened. You'll leave out all the times where you almost broke down, where you almost lost hope, where you didn't behave appropriately, where you almost lost the interest in doing this, where you're not going to tell me that piece. You're just going to tell me all the things, that, especially if you succeeded. It's all going to be about like all the hard work that you put in, not about the failures and the mistakes. So when you hear the story of Badr from the Sahaba, it's beautified. And that's normal because they're people. But the Quran tells it differently. كَمَا أَخْرَجَكَ رَبُّكَ مِن بَيْتِكَ بِالْحَقَّ وَإِنَّ فَرِيقًا مِّنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ لَكَارِهُونَ As your Lord commanded you to leave your home بِالْحَقَّ He commanded you to follow through with righteousness. This is what this ayah means. There's a piece that is deleted here. كَمَا أَخْرَجَكَ رَبُّكَ مِنْ بَيْتِكَ بِالْحَقِّ As you were forced to leave your home in Mecca, as you were forced to do that, بِالْحَقِّ, He commanded you to continue to seek righteousness and to pursue your rights. And he said, عليه الصلاة والسلام, to them that night, we're going after the caravan. And the Sahaba are like, what? Why? What's in it? Our wealth, the wealth that was stolen from us. But Ya Rasulullah, we don't need it anymore. Alhamdulillah, all of us have work now. We've Allah abdalana Allahu khayran mimma akhadha minna. That's what they said. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has replaced us with better and more than what He took from us, whatever was taken from us. They thought it was about the money. And the Prophet alayhi salam said, no, we're going anyways. Ya Rasulullah, but why? Alhamdulillah, everything is nice. It's been a year and a half, it's Ramadan. For the first time, we're not being oppressed. It's a nice community, it's a beautiful time. Why go poke the bear, Ya Rasulullah? Why go poke Quraysh? Why? Why start something? Yeah. So let's count how many times the word... I'll recite the verses for you, and you count with me the number of times he says the word haqq. So, كَمَا أَخْرَجَكَ رَبُّكَ مِنْ بَيْتِكَ بِالْحَقِّ وَإِنَّ فَرِيقًا مِّنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ لَكَارِهُونَ يُجَادِلُونَكَ فِي الْحَقِّ بَعْدَمَا تَبَيَّنَ كَأَنَّمَا يُسَاقُونَ إِلَى الْمَوْتِ وَهُمْ يَنْظُرُونَ وَإِذْ يَعِدُكُمُ اللَّهُ إِحْدَى الطَّائِفَتَيْنِ أَنَّهَا لَكُمْ وَتَوَدُّونَ أَنَّ غَيْرَ ذَاتِ الشَّوْكَةِ تَكُونُ لَكُمْ وَيُرِيدُ اللَّهُ أَنْ يُحِقَّ الْحَقَّ بِكَلِمَاتِهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُجْرِمُونَ لِيُحِقَّ الْحَقَّ وَيُبْطِلَ الْبَاطِلَ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُجْرِمُونَ 6 times in 3 or 4 verses. الحق يحق الحق. It's about righteousness. It's about the truth. It's about doing the right thing. It's not about the money. It's not about the money. The Prophet ﷺ had no interest in money himself. The Sahaba were taught by him ﷺ not to be materialistic. So they weren't after the wealth. But a part of them didn't want to do this because they were like, why? Why start something? وَإِنَّ فَرِيقًا مِّنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ لَكَارِهُونَ There was a group of the believers who absolutely hated this. Not the munafiqeen. No. The mu'mineen. There were no munafiqeen in that army. And he didn't call for this caravan any of the munafiqeen alayhi salatu wasalam. It was only the people who were committed. But even those who were committed, لَكَارِهُونَ, they didn't like this idea. Why go and poke the bear? Why not just, we're good, everything is fine. Life is good, finally. Why go and do this? We don't want the money. Who said anything about money? Who said anything about this being something to do with money? This is about rights. Your rights were taken away from you. You don't stop until you retrieve your rights. You get back what is yours. You don't allow someone to oppress you and then you walk away. You never walk away from oppression. You continue to fight back until that oppression is removed. Then if you want to gift your wealth or gift the land to someone, gift it. Go ahead and gift it. But if they took it away from you in an oppressive manner, then you're going to retrieve it. You are going to continue to fight until you retrieve it. And that is just basic human decency. Decency. I'm not talking, this is a human value that no matter where you come from, or what you believe in, or what ideology you follow, is not only accepted, but it is encouraged. You don't bend backwards. You don't walk away from an act of oppression and transgression and just say, oh, I didn't want it anyway. No. You go back and take what's yours. You go back and fight for what's yours. And then when you have it, if you didn't want it, give him back. Here, give it back. It's not about the thing. It's about the right. You transgressed against me. You took away my rights. And that can't be okay. That's not okay. We're not okay with that. We're not okay with our fundamental rights being taken away from us. And there's nothing that makes up for a right that was taken away. I don't care what you offer in return. No, no. You give me back what's mine. And then, if I don't want it, fadl, I'll give it to you. But I'll give it to you ala kif. I'll give it to you based on my will, not based on your oppressive approach. Understand? This is an issue of izz. This is an issue of integrity, of honor, of righteousness, of haqq, of haqq. The Sahaba thought it was about the money. It wasn't about the money. That's why the ayah is saying it's bil haqq. It's liyuhiqq al haqq. Yujadilunaka fil haqq. They were arguing with you regarding righteousness, regarding fil haqq, regarding rights. بعدما تبين, after it became clear, كأنما يساقون إلى الموت وهم ينظرون, after it became clear that they felt that they were being walked and marched towards their deaths, they were scared. That's why this day was a big day. Never in their lifetime had anyone opposed and defied Quraysh like that. No one. No one dared, because Quraysh was too powerful financially, was too powerful socially, was too powerful militarily. It just didn't make any sense for anyone to do. They had too many treaties with people. It made no sense. And the Muslim country was way too small. It's still weak. The army was only 8 months old. There's almost no training done yet. So they were scared. وَإِذْ يَعِدُكُمُ اللَّهُ إِحْدَى الطَّائِفَتَيْنِ أَنَّهَا لَكُمْ. So the Prophet ﷺ told them, to make it easier for them, Allah promises you one of two things, either the caravan or that you are victorious against them. وَتَوَدُّونَ أَنَّ غَيْرَ ذَاتِ الشَّوْكَةِ تَكُونُ لَكُمْ. And everyone who was sitting listening to him were hoping just the caravan. I just hope I get the caravan. No war. That is shoka. Shoka is when you're pricked, when you feel pain. You're hoping that the one that has pain in it doesn't happen. وَيُرِيدُ اللَّهُ أَن يُحِقَّ الْحَقَّ بِكَلِمَاتِهِ وَيَقْطَعَ دَابِرَ الْكَافِرِينَ. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants something different. Allah wanted for righteousness to be established, and for the oppression and the arrogance of the disbelievers to be cut short. لِيُحِقَّ الْحَقَّ. May He always, subhanahu wa ta'ala, establish righteousness. وَيُبْطِلَ الْبَاطِلِ. And establish falsehood as in its clarity. وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُجْرِمُونَ. Even if the criminals don't like it, it doesn't matter. That's why they went for Badr. Badr wasn't about the caravan. It wasn't about money. It was about rights. You were oppressed. Something was taken away from you. Against your will, your basic rights were oppressed. You go back and you stand up for yourself. Stand up for yourself. There's no, I forgave. No. You forgive after you retrieve it. Retrieve your right, then forgive. Then forgive. Al-afu what? Al-afu inda al-maqdira. Your afu, when you pardon someone, is when you have the ability. When you have the upper hand, when you're no longer the lower hand. You're the lower hand, you fight until you are equal. And then you can forgive. This is an Islamic principle. This is a core Islamic value. It's the integrity of a Muslim. It has nothing to do with arrogance, has nothing to do with hunger for blood or loving combat. No, it has to do with huquq, with rights, with haqq, with righteousness, with the truth, with doing the right thing. And the Sahaba for a moment there got a little bit too comfortable. It was easy to get comfortable. I would have been comfortable too. You're praying in the Prophet ﷺ's masjid. You pray behind him in salah every night. He gives you a dars every day. You spend time with him. It's safe. People are getting along. It's a beautiful community. So Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and Ali and Zubayr and Talha and Sa'id and Sa'd. Amazing people. Why would you want to go and poke the bear? Why rock the boat when everything is nice and steady? No. Then you never forget what is correct. You never do. We do. 6 weeks. That's how far we'll... any musibah happens anywhere. 6 weeks, people get all upset. And then they forget about it. How do you think they were able to hold on to that for 75 years? Huh? How do you think this happens for over a year and a half? Because we lose our passion within a couple of weeks. We lose our energy. We lose our focus. The day that you're oppressed, your focus is on fixing that, removing that oppression until it's removed. Until it's removed. There is no raha, there is no rest for Muslims until they remove the oppression. Until they remove their oppression and retrieve their rights. Acknowledging their mistakes on the way. and being objective about it and not being scared of it. This is what why would we study his life alayhi salatu wasalam if we're not going to apply any of it? Like, why study it if we have no interest in applying it? It's about applying these teachings. This is how the Sahaba went through the same thing. They were oppressed and they were weaker. And they were told, no, when you make a mistake, you made a mistake. We're not going to polish it up for you and cover it so it doesn't look good. No, we're going to say it was a mistake and acknowledge and accept and admit it. And then you're going to go, even though you're afraid, and even though you're lesser in numbers and lesser in arsenal and everything. You're going to go and you're going to fight for your what is rightfully yours. What is rightfully yours. And that's what Badr is about. So, what happened was, Abu Sufyan is seasoned. Abu Sufyan is probably one of the smartest men in Arabia at the time and continued to be. So what do you know? He knew that Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam had his eye on this. He knew that this was not a normal caravan that he was taking. So that's why he took way more guards than he used to. And that's why he had his own intelligence groups. So once they found out the Prophet ﷺ had some intention, he changed his route. He changed his route altogether. And he went by the Sahil. The Sahil, which is by the shore. Like, he went close to the sea, which is not the typical route a caravan with 1,000 camels would take. But he changed his route altogether to get as far away from Medina as he could. And he put a man he had with him. He took this guy with him on purpose. Abu Sufyan was not smart. He took a guy with him. His name was Amr ibn Dhamdham. So Amr had only one job. Amr was the type of person that if you wanted news to get around, you told him. You want the news to get around? Tell him. News will get around. So he told Amr ibn Dhamdham, you're going to go. You're going to gallop down to Mecca. And you're going to let Quraysh know. You're going to tell them that Muhammad has taken the caravan of Abu Sufyan. Which is a lie, because it didn't happen. But that's what he did. So Amr, he goes down. This is the narration that we have of how he entered. قَالَ فَدَخَلَ مَكَّةَ قَالَ فَجَلَسَ الْقَهْقَرَ عَلَى رَاحِلَتِهِ. So usually you sit on your camel with face forward. So he turned around on the camel. قَالَ وَجَرَحَ الْجَمَلِ. And he made cuts on the camel, so the camel was bleeding. And then he took off his shirt and he painted himself in the blood of the camel. And he's on the way in, he's coming backwards, he's slapping his face. يَقُولُ اللَّطِيمَةَ اللَّطِيمَةَ الْغَدْرَ الْغَدْرَ. He's screaming. He's making a scene. He's a scene. People look at him. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. What is this? So all of Mecca come running. What happened? غَدَرَ مُحَمَّدٌ بِقَافِلَتِنَا. Muhammad has taken the qafila, Abu Sufyan, he has taken it. And of course, the anger begins. Abu Jahl immediately puts together the troops. Abu Jahl stands and he swears that we are going to go to where Muhammad is. We're going to get back our caravan. We're going to kill him and his people. And they're going to stay there for a week, slaughtering and eating and partying and drinking. That's what he told people. We're going to go do this. We're going to make a busy. And everyone has to leave. So all of the men in Mecca started to prepare themselves. So a little kind of caveat to the story. It was a couple of days before this. Atika bint Abd al-Muttalib, the Prophet alayhi salallahu alayhi wa sallam's aunt, also a Muslim, saw in her dream a man coming and standing on Safa, which is the mountain that the Prophet ﷺ stood on when he announced Islam. And of course, when you do Umrah, you stand there. She would see in her dream a man standing on Safa. يقول يا آل غدر موعدكم بعد ثلاث. Oh, people of treason, people of betrayal, talking about the people of Mecca. Your time is in 3 days. Your time is in 3 days. And she saw this. I saw this dream a couple of times in a row. Every time the days would go down. So she went and she told her brother, Al-Abbas ibn Abd al-Muttalib. And she told him, don't tell anyone. So just as a side note, so if you don't want people to know your business, don't tell anybody, right? Ever, like no one at all. The moment you tell one person, expect and accept that within a little bit of time, whether that time is a couple of hours, if you're unlucky, or a couple of years, everyone will know this. If you actually don't want anyone to know, then keep it to yourself. Tell yourself. Stand in front of the mirror and talk to yourself for a little bit and keep your voice down so no one hears on the other side of the door. Don't tell anyone. The moment your secret leaves your lips, it's gone. Khalas. And don't get upset. Well, I thought they would hold to you. You did. Again, miskeen. You're miskeen. You're very naive if you think, no, impossible. The Abbas went and told someone and told him, don't tell anyone else, this is a secret. By the end of the night, all of Mecca knew and all of Mecca was holding on to it. And Abu Jahl came because he heard it. And he knocked on the door of Bani Hashim. And he said, أَصْبَحَتِ النِّسَاءُ عِنْدَكُمْ نَبِيَّاتٍ. Now your women are also prophets. It's not enough that we have a man who is claiming prophecy amongst you. Now your women are also prophets. Huh? She has visions. وَاللَّهِ لَإِنْ لَمْ يَحْصُلْ شَيْءٍ بَعْدَ ثَلَاثَةِ أَيَّامٍ لَنَكْتُبَنَّ صَحِيفَةً عَلَيْهَا بَنُو هَاشِمْ أَكْذَبُ الْعَرَبِ وَنُعَلِّقُهَا فِي الْكَعْبَةِ. If nothing happens in the next 3 days, we're going to write on a piece of paper that Banu Hashim are the biggest liars of all of Arab, and we're going to hang it in the Kaaba. And of course, something happened. And then, of course, Amr ibn Dhamdham made sure it was very clear that something happened. So Abu Jahl would, you know, prepare. Are we good? You guys need 2 minutes? Okay, good. Okay, yeah. So Abu Jahl would start preparing his troops. As he's preparing everyone, two people decided that, yeah, we're good. Abu Lahab and Umayyah bin Khalaf. Abu Lahab said, I can't go. I can't, I have a business and it's my nephew, so I can't go. And he paid for someone to go on his behalf. Arab used to do this. So if you had enough money, you could pay someone to go fight on your behalf. And Abu Lahab used the example that he's my nephew, so I'm not going to go and do this. Abu Lahab, obviously, what would happen later, is on their way there, like during the time that it took for them to go for the battle and come back, Abu Lahab would be hit over the head by the sister of one of his servants. He would slap a servant of his over the face. The kid would go and complain to his older sister. She would come with a big branch, slap him on the head, open up his head, causing him an infection. The Arab back then, medicine was not that advanced. They thought that what he has was contagious, so he was quarantined into his home. And people got scared, so they would send his food tied to a dog. They would tie the food to a dog and send the dog into the house. And then once he died out of the infection, they basically brought down the house on top of him, out of fear of what he had. تَبَّتْ يَدَ أَبِي لَهَبٍ وَتَبَّ. As the Quran said, as the Quran predicted, that no, it's your hands that تَبَّتْ. Your hands are the ones that are foolish. Your hands are the ones that are going to be punished, not Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. And that's how he died. A person who defied the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam 7 times publicly, and alayhi salatu wasalam not once replied to him. Never once did he ever say a bad word to him. Not once. In all of his life, alayhi salam, not once did he say, khalas ya ammi, not a word. Never addressed his uncle in a bad way. Never worry about people who mistreat you. I'm not talking about oppression here. I'm talking about day-to-day mistreatments. Don't worry about people who don't treat you well. Forget about them. Don't waste your energy and time with them. What goes around in life comes around. What goes around comes around. All good in life and all bad in life are boomerangs. You throw them out, give it enough time, it'll come back at you. You do good, all that khair will come back at you. You do shar, don't worry. Someone who mistreats you, someone who doesn't do well by you, leave it, it'll come back. They'll pay for it in the future. And Abu Dhab did. The Prophet alayhi salallahu alayhi wa sallam did not have to lift a finger. The other person who stayed back, and I'll let you guys read the Kahoot, is Umayyah bin Khalaf. You know why Umayyah bin Khalaf stayed back? Umayyah was the master or the owner of Sayyidina Bilal al-Habashi radiallahu anhu. And he oppressed Bilal, right? And he used to put the boulder on Bilal's chest and tell him, say Hubal, and he would say Ahud, Ahadun, Ahad, and the whole story, right? We talked about this. So one day Bilal came, Umayyah was torturing him, and Bilal said, Ya Umayyah, Wallahi inni laqatiluk. Oh Umayyah, no, one day the day will come where I will kill you. فَقَالَ مَا تَقُولُ. What is this? أخبرك بهذا محمد. Did Muhammad tell you this? فقال نعم أخبرني رسول الله. The Prophet told me one day I'll come and kill you. فقال أخبرك. Are you sure he said this to you? قال فمسكها أمية. أمية got scared. And the day the battle happened, he's like, no, I'm good. I'm good. Bilal was already in Medina with the Prophet. He said, I'm not going. So Abu Jahl and his friends would come and bring Bakhur. You know Bakhur? And they would walk around him with Bakhur, saying, here, sit like the ladies. Bakhur, make a Bakhur, stay in Mecca. Kind of mocking him. You're chicken, huh? Stay back. Don't go. Don't go with the men and fight. Stay back. And Umayyah would look at them and say, Wallahi innakum tasuqunani ila maqtali. You're taking me to my death. You're taking me to my end. I know it. And he went. And he went. He eventually went, and I'll tell you the continuation of this story, inshallah ta'ala, next week. Subhanakallah bihamdik.